there may be equal a environment for mid-major basketball, but there's not going to be a better environment than when Kent State plays Akron at either facility, at either arena. And their fans are ruthless. I mean, their fans are mean. Their fans are mean. Our fans, I don't think, are as mean to them as they are to us. But I could be wrong. I may be biased there.
Wait, Coach. But, yeah. Coach, are you hooking us up with some tickets? Welcome back to another episode, Not Even D2. I'm your host, KJ Allison, here with my boy and co-host, Neruda Perdomo. We got a great episode where we talk with Kent State head coach, Rob Senderoff, really good coach, one of the all-time winningest coach in Kent State history. We talked about a lot with Coach, but first, bro, we recording on a Tuesday, so the finals is 3-2, Oklahoma City up right now. I just want to hear your thoughts, what you're seeing so far, and let's talk about the NBA a little bit.
Yeah, definitely a great game six or game five performance from the Thunder. They came to play from the jump. J-Dub showed up, 40 ball. He was putting on some great moves. Role players showed up, and that's what you want to see. And their defense was suffocating on the Pacers. So, you know, like I was saying, Thunder and six, you know, especially with Haliburton kind of hobbled at this point, I think Thunder just finished it out in Gainbridge Fieldhouse.
I think a lot of attention went to Tyrese not being 100%, which he clearly wasn't, but I don't think, like, Tyrese not being – because Tyrese was playing like that for most of the series. I mean, in the clutch, obviously Tyrese does his thing, but even before he got hurt, he was getting locked up. So I don't think that much attention should go to the calf injury. That when he was on the bench, they went on a crazy run. So I think this Pacers team is good without Tyrese. But like you mentioned, Dub with the 40 ball is crazy. And I think that really just showed the NBA that – He's one of them. I was saying last episode he could be one of the best players in the league, but he put it on the biggest stage, and 40 points, like, not many people can say they had 40 in the finals. He was pulling – they were comparing his last move on Nembhard, or Nesmith, comparing it to Jordan and Kobe, and I was like, yo, he really has a lot of similarities to those type of guys with his two-way capabilities. And – another thing, Shea and Dub, when one's playing good, the other one usually isn't as good. But the game five was kind of our first time seeing, especially in the playoffs, both of them playing at such a high level. So as a Thunder fan, I'm super excited. Got to close it out. But like you said, Tyrese not being 100%, you know, our defense was crazy. It's definitely getting compared to like the best Bulls teams or the Pistons Pistons defense, and it's really up there. I mean, there's possessions where I'm watching, they're setting a screen and AC is the on-ball defender, and then the switch guy is Lou Dort. So it's a tough defense, bro. But we don't want to talk too much NBA.
I will say though, I feel like they should have put TJ McConnell in at some point in the fourth quarter. Like, you know, you are right. Like, you know, Haliburton had some games before, but, you know, he had 18 the game before, 22 the game prior, like, and he makes them go with, like, especially Miles Turner and stuff. But they definitely could have, especially Nembhard not playing well either, like, they could have used TJ McConnell more in the clutch yesterday, and I expect them to rely on him a lot next game.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting discussion. Just because, say, like, TJ McConnell was having a great game, but even when he started feeling himself, he started doing some things that he had a travel, a turnover, and a missed three. So I'm not saying he played bad or anything, but if you're leaving Tyrese on the bench and you still lose that game, then everyone's coming on to their shows or the media saying, oh, you can't leave your best player on the bench regardless. Like, if he's suited up and he's near health or near 100% health, you got to let him go. So I agree with what you said, but I'm just saying that if they still lost that game with TJ McConnell, then people would be criticizing Rick Carlisle. So I'm not going to take that route, but that's definitely a good point that you brought up. But let's talk about today's episode with Coach Senderoff, bro, because, I mean, one of, I think, three or four coaches with minimum 10 seasons coached and never had a losing season. That is crazy. So he's showing that regardless of who I have in the locker room, I'm going to at least be, you know, mid or to high of the MAC pack. So this is a really good coach, and it was a really good conversation. So just talk to me about this episode, bro.
Definitely a great conversation. Appreciate Coach Senderoff for getting on the pod. And I mean, you're right. He got Kent State playing the right way. Like you mentioned, they never had a losing season. You know, I had mentioned a stat in the episode that he had. I kind of had said the stat the wrong way. So overall, when you think about out of conference, in conference, he's never had a losing season. But when you look at like his in conference record or out of conference record, he's only had a losing season one time, which is kind of tough for like a mid-major. You know what I mean? Like, especially like, you know, mid-majors want to play the good teams, and he's only had a losing record out of conference one time, which is crazy. And, you know, they play hard, bro. That's a big part of their program. You know, toughness on the ball, defense. And I loved his mindset about, you know, letting his guards go to work, which, you know, watching them play, you could really see that he lets them dance, which is fire. And you could tell on the court that they're bought into his system, like, you know, just talking on defense and being aggressive. So definitely Coach Senderoff is coaching a great program. And it's you know, we definitely got to catch Akron versus Kent State next year.
Yeah, we definitely got to be there. That was a good part of the episode talking about that. But like you said, they're all bought in. And part of this is Coach Senderoff was talking about it. He's very confident in what he's teaching. I'm not saying this is always a good thing when you're basically like, this is how we're doing it, and I don't want to basically hear your guys' opinions on how we cover a ball screen or what we're doing on the offensive end. But when you have a dominant, assertive coach that's just like, this is how it is, and it's shown that it's going to work. So it allows his players to buy in that much more. But also, bro, we were talking about some of his defensive philosophies, and I think a lot of coaches can take stuff from, you know, what he's doing. We didn't even talk about this, but he has this philosophy where if a player spins, like, no matter in that half court set, they're just attacking. Like, you're on full go at the ball. The ball, the nearest ball side defender is just attacking the ball. So it's little things like that, but that is instilled through his program that's allowing Kent State to, you know, keep prevailing to, you know, over 500 records in the MAC year to year. But like you said, he's a really good coach. I think the only other coaches that have never had losing seasons with minimum 10 seasons coach is Mark Few at Gonzaga, Tom Izzo at Michigan State, and I forgot who the other one was, but he's been coaching all around. So one of three coaches to stay at one school and, you know, just dominate basically. So it's really cool getting to talk to Coach Senderoff. This is a really good episode, and let's hear from Coach Senderoff. All right, we are here with our guy, Coach Senderoff. How you doing today, Coach?
I'm doing great, fellas. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, really appreciate you getting on, Coach. What you been up to today?
Yeah, just we're getting ready for summer school with our guys coming in next week and just trying to get ourselves organized and prepared because, you know, big 8 weeks for us, for everybody right now. But for us, we're just trying to make sure that we have everything set and ready to go. For when they arrive here over the weekend and then to start up next week.
I got you. We got a lot to talk about basketball-wise, but before we get into that, I'm kind of curious what Coach Senderoff's life is outside of sports. So if you could talk about, like, what hobbies, what you like doing outside of hoop.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, in the spring, a couple weeks, I like to golf. Not very well, but I like to get out there and golf. During the time that we have off, I collect the other thing that I do. I collect cards. So I collect basketball sports cards. Yeah. So that's the other thing that I spend a lot of time on outside of basketball. So that's really about it. And I watch right now. I watch every game, which I like. I watch all the playoff games. So during this little break between the finals, you know, starting and you know, the Eastern Conference, Western Conference finals, I've been waiting for some games, so I'm looking forward to those starting up here soon too.
Coach, quick question. A lot of times as players, right, we'll watch the NBA playoffs and you know, we'll try to take moves or something like that from a specific player. But, you know, coaches, I'm wondering, are you watching the coaches and seeing different schematics or plays that they're running and like, oh, yeah, I need that?
Yeah, I think most coaches, I could be wrong, but I certainly will speak for myself. I definitely am watching the game from a different lens than my players are watching the game from, because I know sometimes I come in the next day and I may say something to somebody about, hey, did you see how they switched, you know, this screening action or whatever it may be? And they have no clue, you know, a guy that I'm talking to, and he may then say, oh, did you see the inside out, whatever? And I'm paying no mind to that, because that's not what I'm watching and that's not what they're watching. So I definitely am watching the game from a different lens than most. First of all, most players, I think, and most fans for sure. I don't have a rooting interest necessarily, but I am enjoying seeing, you know, all of the different things that the coaches are doing, the players are doing, how they're executing, you know, under pressure after timeouts and things like that.
You're from Rockland County. Are you a Knicks fan or no?
I'm a Knicks fan. Yeah. I grew up a Knicks fan. Yeah, I'm a Knicks fan. Absolutely.
Coach, yeah. I don't know if you can see, but that's a Thunder logo over there. So you know who we're going for. But
yeah. I'm rooting. I the Thunder are a really enjoyable team to watch, as are the Pacers. That just because I root for the Knicks, because that's who I grew up rooting for. You know, you can't help but you know, watch the way the Thunder play or watch the way the Pacers play and be like, boy, they share the ball, they defend, they don't care. It doesn't seem like they don't care who shines, so to speak. 100%. They're all uplifting their teammates. And that, for any coach, is something you can point to your team to try to get your guys to play and emulate that style. So I love watching those teams play. Just, you know, like when the Pacers are playing the Knicks, I'm rooting for the Knicks. Like, I have a rooting interest, hoping the Knicks would have won.
Yeah. I was going to say, you must be in coach's heaven too, because I think these are the best two, like, offensive minds that we have in the NBA right now. At least, like, getting their guys in positions to succeed with Rick Carlisle and Mark Daigneault. You could probably look at a lot of their sets and try to implement that stuff for next year.
Yeah, I think all of those, like, when you – listen to, I was fortunate enough last week, I got to listen to a couple of NBA coaches talk. Those guys have more basketball acumen, just the basketball X's and O's and moving guys around the court and how to defend and switches. I listened to a G League coach too. They have more basketball acumen in their pinky than I probably do in my entire body, because they leave the court and that's what they're doing totally, you know. And I was actually talking to a coaching friend of mine after that visit that we have, and, you know, we leave these sort of clinics or gatherings and then we're talking about getting guys into school and making sure, you know, their physicals are ready, and then the recruiting weekends and recruiting on campus and our camps, et cetera, et cetera. And they don't, that's 90% of our day, and 10% of our day is talking about the basketball, the drills, the things we're doing to try to help these guys improve. Whereas in the NBA and G League, it's the opposite. It's 90% of their day is spent on basketball, and you're going to get, you know, you're going to have unbelievable ideas and understanding of angles and everything because of that. So it's awesome when you get a chance to share a room, you know, with guys like that, just because you get such an unbelievable amount of knowledge just by being in the same room with those guys.
That's a good point. It's interesting because a lot of college coaches, they'll get into the NBA and, you know, you hear different perspectives on whether they like that change of lifestyle or not. But I just found it interesting you pointed that out. But I want to talk about you a little bit. So you just signed a contract extension. It's a 6-year deal, take you through the year 2030 to 31. And it was actually released, or it was a rumor, I should say, that you were going to take the job at Fordham with your New York background. You had a connection with Charles Guthrie, the Fordham athletic director. So I'm just curious about like this whole process and what your thought process was throughout the contract extension, whether to leave to Fordham or stay at Kent State.
Yeah, well, it's always, you know, a good thing when you're a coach, I guess, when anybody's interested in talking to you from another school, because it says that your team has had success and your program's had success. So, you know, the fact that there were rumors that I had taken a job or accepted a job when I hadn't even been offered a job at that time was like, you know, sometimes these things on the internet get spun really, really quickly. But you know, there was communication with another school, and that's not something I've shied away from. At the end of the day, you know, Kent has been, I've been the head coach here now 14 years, and I've been here for over 20 years total with 2 years in between at Indiana. And the school made a really big commitment to our program here, which, you know, I wasn't sure they were going to do, but once they did that and made that the decision to really fully invest in our program, it was, you know, it was a lot easier for me to say, hey, you know what, I want to continue to coach at Kent State. You know, in a lot of ways, you know, sometimes you've been at a place for a long time and you think you need a new challenge, but they've created, our program is now in a different place. It is somewhat of a new job, you know, because of the investment is significantly different than what it was just 4 months ago into our program. So right now, as we're speaking, they're redoing our entire gym is getting redone. So during the summer, we're just going to be in our practice facility because they're redoing the arena floor, which will not just help our program, but it'll also help volleyball and the other sports that play here, because we've needed, you know, a new floor in here. But there have been other significant changes to help our program. And in this landscape, as you know, because you're involved in the sport, you know, if you're not advancing, you're really falling behind. And that can happen really, really quickly.
Blink of an eye.
Yeah, in the blink of an eye. And you can go from being really successful as a program to really irrelevant as a program quickly, and vice versa. You can go from irrelevant to really, really successful quickly. And you've seen that with a lot of different examples, and I see you both shaking your head, in college basketball over the last few years. So when our president and AD – you know, saw the value that our program brings to the university, which, again, I think our program brings tremendous value to our university. This is the third largest school in the state of Ohio, in Northeast Ohio, at Kent State. You know, the winters are tough. You know, it is Northeast Ohio, you know, like Albany. Winters aren't easy. So to be able to come, you know, to the Mac Center, which is where we play, as our students, we have an awesome band and chew, like, for everybody to be able to in the community say, okay, the home basketball games are going to be events for our community and for our students. Like, that's a big deal. And once that commitment was made to the program, it became an easier decision for me to not want to leave or pursue something else at this time. So, you know, it's humbling because, again, I've been here a long time, but I'm also really happy that you know, we're able to, our whole staff, guys that played here at Kent State, which is unique too. Almost all my staff are former players here at Kent that, like, okay, we can stay here and continue to grow and build the program in a manner that'll allow us to have success. Because if you're not committed, you know, resource-wise, you just can't have success any longer in Division One.
Coach, you made some great points. And one thing I wanted to point out, there's two things I wanted to point out. first thing, I mean, I don't think you've had a losing season overall. Maybe one time in the MAC conference, but out of conference, you've never had a losing season. So at that point, the Kent State fans and the university knows what type of product that you're putting out on the floor, right? They're gonna come support and they're gonna, you know, enjoy watching you guys play. Number one, and then number two, you know, when you think about college basketball where it is today, right? The transfer portal, guys moving up levels, moving to different schools. It's happened at the coaching ranks too. Coaches leaving, you know, really good, you know, coaches moving up, like coach the West Virginia coach going to Indiana, right? Perfect example, or North Texas coach leaving. But you're at Kent State. You're like, you know what? I love what we're building here. I love what we have built here. So I want to stay here. So I can only commend you for that, you know?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. And you know what? You're 100% right. We tell our guys, our players, this too. And you know, everybody's had players transfer. And that's just the nature of what this is. But, you know, we want our program to be one where, A, you want to develop and you want to get better. And B, that, you know, that it's tough. You don't want to leave. I mean, again, there may be a situation where whether it's financially, you have no choice but to leave. Okay. Or, you know, playing time wise after a few years, it just hasn't gone the way you want it to go or need it to go for you individually. And you feel like, hey, I have to go find another opportunity. Great. You know, like that's going to happen, but we don't want the program to be a revolving door of people coming in and going out, spending 1 year here, leaving, going another year, nor do I want the players that I bring in for it to just be 1 year. I'm using you for a year. And then I don't care what you do moving forward. Like, I don't think that benefits anyone really. Now, at the same time, like, hey, if we can help you, achieve your goals as a player, well, of course, that's what we want to do. That's part of our, in fact, that's why we're here, right? Is to help you achieve your goals. And if you can do that and help us continue to win, everybody's happy. And we're fortunate. I'm fortunate. My staff's fortunate. Like this past year, we graduated five really, really good players, maybe a six, but we had seven guys that could return, eight guys that could return, and seven of the eight chose to return. You know, the one that didn't, we left on great terms. It was a situation, again, where he just wasn't playing a ton and was like, hey, coach, I need to find another place where I can play more. And in fact, like when he found that place, you know, his dad sent me a long text thanking me for, you know, how we've handled and worked with his son. And again, his son, I'm sure, thought he should play more. And I'm not saying that his son's wrong. And his dad, I'm sure, thought his son should play more. And I'm not saying his dad's wrong. But sometimes we, as coaches, you have to make tough decisions. And playing time is probably, from the player side, the toughest decision that I have to make, me and my staff have to make. So you just want to make sure that everybody's trying to go towards the build towards the right thing and that we're all moving in the right direction. And we have been fortunate. We've had a lot of success. Not every year have we won a championship. Almost every year we've been competing for one. And that's really, you know, at this level, you know, in the Big Ten, if you're Kent State, you've gone to the NCAA tournament for 14 years. You've probably got, maybe 11 out of 14 years, maybe 12. I don't know the exact number. But in the MAC, that's just not how it works. Only one team goes to the NCAA tournament. This year, we were fortunate because of how we scheduled in the non-conference and because of how we played in the non-conference that, you know, we got invited to the NIT. And then we play in the NIT and we beat St. Bonaventure at St. Bonaventure, Stanford at Stanford. And then we lose to Loyola Chicago, on the road. And they beat us pretty soundly, but great environment, unbelievable environment. And that was a great experience. Three nationally televised games for our team. We're playing in postseason. hard to win in March because, you know, it's careers ending in March. It's seasons ending in March. So, you know, there's a lot of things we're proud of here. And again, I think locally, you know, our fans have tremendous, you know, they're great. We have great fans, great support, great student support here at Kent. And again, what we've tried to do is give our players the best possible experience we can here. And coach, you know, people always say, well, you know, are you afraid to coach these guys because they may leave? No, I'm not. I think guys want to be coached. I actually think the guys that are afraid to coach their guys, those are the ones that guys leave. Because players, good players, want to be coached. If you don't want to be coached, then what are we doing? Like, what are we doing if you don't want to be coached? So, and if you don't want to be coached, then this probably isn't a great place for you. Great. There's a 360 other ones. Find one that's good for you. You know, that's sort of how we've done it. And again, for the most part, not every year, not every game, but for the most part, we've graduated our players. I think, again, in 14 years, I think it's now like 49 guys have finished playing here without eligibility, meaning they're done, and 48 out of 49 have gotten their degrees, you know, that have finished playing here. So I've literally had one player leave Kent that could no longer play basketball that didn't receive his degree. So, like, I'm as proud of that as anything else, because that's part of, and a big part of, like, my mission as a coach is to try to prepare guys for life.
Yeah, I love that, coach. And, like, right now in Division One, a lot of coaches kind of talk about the transfer portal and say you can't build a program with how the transfer portal is, but you're showing, like, one, I'm going to get guys from the portal and they're going to stay in my program. That's the first thing. And the second thing, they're still going to graduate, have good careers, win, and get their degree. So you're proving that at a school, wherever you are, if you do it the right way, you can still be traditionally like a hard coach and still have the success, the benefits, and the players still enjoy their time at Kent State or wherever you were the coach.
No doubt. And again, there may be a year here, maybe after this year, that we lose seven guys. Like, it happens. And there, you know, that's not in my world, in my eyes, like, that's not an indictment on a coach when that happens. It's not. It might be an indictment on the situation. You know, the situation might not be good. You know, it might be unfortunate for a number of reasons. I certainly never look at it and say, well, something's wrong with that coach because all their players left. Like, I don't look at it that way. I usually think something's wrong with the situation. You know, we've been fortunate again. You know, I don't know what's going to happen at the end of this year. My hope again would be we try to bring guys in and develop them. And as many that think Kent is the best situation for them moving forward, I hope we're able to maintain a great core of players. And then we'll supplement with high school and transfers because, you know, we don't want to be in a situation where we're not competing. We want to be able to compete every year. And you have to be older to do that. You have to have experience to do that. You have to have guys develop to do that. So, you know, that's the goal, and we'll try, you know, and we're going to keep working at it every year.
I mean, you guys are building it seems to me, just hearing you talk about your program, right? Like, you have players, you talk about how some of your staff, or all your staff, you know, they play for you, right? So you're creating this family dynamic, which can even entice the player to stay that much more.
I think that's all been part of it here. Again, you know, like, Kent is not, if you come to Kent and you came to visit and you're here, you know, it's a special place and it's a unique place. And if you go nationally, if you look around the country, there's a lot of, it's really interesting how many Division I college basketball coaches played at Kent State. You'd be shocked at the number of people that there are out there. You know, Jordan Mincy's the head coach at Jacksonville. Played at Kent State. I was the assistant that helped recruit him here. Kevin Szabo, an assistant at Canisius. Armon Gates, assistant. I'm trying to think where Armand just went. At Minnesota, he just went to Minnesota. He was at Oklahoma. DeAndre Haynes was the player of the year in this league. He's an assistant at Marquette. Anthony Wilkins is an assistant at UNLV. Eric Hout is an assistant. He's the defensive coordinator at Utah State. I know I'm missing guys, but like those are all. Oh, Jules Sullinger, who is our associate head coach here for a number of years, assistant at Duquesne. All of those guys played at Kent State along with my three assistant coaches that all played here. And then there have been a number of GAs and guys like that who have gotten into coaching as well and that are at a number of different places. So, like, for a school like Kent State to have that many people out there, you know, it's just unique. So again, when you play here and you're like, hey, if I finish it out here, you know you're going to get looked after for like, hey, you're part of the deal. Like, if this is what you want to do, almost every one of our players that wants to go play after college has gotten an opportunity to play. I think it's like 35 guys have gotten professional contracts after playing. So, okay, you want to go play after school? Great, you're going to get an opportunity there. You want to get into coaching or something like that? We have a whole slew of people that are going to be looking after you. And then if you want to get into get a real job, I call it a real job because coaching's not a real job. Like this, I wear sweatsuit to work or a t-shirt. Like, you know, if you want to get a real job, we can help you with that too, because we have such a network of alums and people that care. There's a Fortune 500 company, you know, headquartered in Kent. So we have a great situation for a young guy who's looking to prove themselves, you know, as a basketball player.
Man, I always love when coaches talk about their coaching tree, and it's awesome that you're proud of that, right? You want to, like, it's literally on your bio, like talking about your coaching tree. And, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with this one coach, Coach Dave Paulson.
He
coaches at Holy Cross right now. He's, you know, legendary D3 coach, but he has a huge coaching tree.
Yeah.
He's really proud of it too. And it's awesome to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. I know Dave.
Yeah. He's the man. So, Coach, you've had 9 20-win seasons and 8 postseason appearances, and I'm just wondering, what's been, like, the biggest challenge in sustaining success for really over a decade?
Yeah, just that each team is new, and, like, what you did the year prior has nothing to do with what's going to happen the year moving forward. Like, that's the biggest thing is, like, you know, it's funny because the years after – going to the NCAA tournament for us have been our most challenging years. And it's not for a lack of talent after that. It's not like, I mean, you know, we've had guys graduate. So but it's not for a lack of talent. That's not the reason why it's been challenging. It's, you know, our ability as coaches and our players' ability to understand, like, what happened last year is not going to carry over to this year.
Yeah, you lose that drive, the hunger. When you finish, like, last in the conference, it's like, we can't do that again. But when you finish first, then your head gets a little bigger. You lose that hunger. And then on the flip side, those teams in your conference, they see that you just had all that success, and they're like, we kind of want to – when we go into that gym, we, like, that's the game we're circling. We want that game to be like our performance, our standout performance.
Yeah, no question. And that's the challenge. Like, that's the challenge, I think, for every coach. And you know, like, you know, I'm sure there's other coaches in our league right now who, you know, they have their challenges too because of either A, not having success and saying, hey, that's never going to happen again, and how hungry their guys need to be and are, or vice versa, where it's like, hey, you're trying to make the next step or as a program or whatever that might be. But that to me is the toughest thing is your guys understanding what happened last year has nothing to do with what's going to happen this upcoming year.
100%. Yeah. It's like, it's a clean slate almost. Like, yeah, you can have you know, returning guys, but really, like you said, it's a whole new season, right?
Yep.
And, you know, with the way college basketball is now, you know, the other teams in the conference may have different teams too. So you can't, you kind of got to watch that over and be like, look, like, this is the culture, this is the standard, but this is a whole new year that we're gonna approach this maybe a little bit differently.
No doubt. And then, and nowadays, like when you go through, like when you're playing another team, you know, and you're getting ready for that game and you look at your scouting report and you go through their roster, and it's like everybody has guys that produced someplace else. Like you're not going through, you know, it used to be, oh, well, they're starting three freshmen and, you know, one sophomore or whatever it might be. Well, now it's like, well, they're starting three guys who average 14 a game at this school, and this school, and a guy who averaged 11 a game at this school. And you're like, dang, man, every, you know, these guys are all talented guys. Like, you go across the board, it's like, dang, there's not, the talent is there. And then it's just like, how do you get guys to buy in, you know, to team over individual and do the things it takes to win. That's tough. And you know, we've been fortunate. And I put the point guard position, like that position's really important. That position, we have a good one. I mean, we have a really good point guard, a kid named Sion Medley, he played for, you know, Coach Brunson, Jalen Brunson's dad. Rick Brunson was his high school coach at Camden High School for a couple of years before he went back to the NBA to work with the Knicks. So, like, when you have a good point guard, that makes a world of difference.
And I was actually at the Kent State versus St. Bonaventure game this year, and you're doing a lot of – this is actually a question I was going to ask you, but so you're doing a lot of two-guard things because you had him and Jalen – with the ball in their hands a lot of the time. And I'm noticing a lot of the times, at least in that game, they were able to, like, play free. If they had, like, a good matchup, they were able to get in their bag, break down, like, one-on-one stuff. So I was just curious how you kind of, like, one, about the two-guard stuff, what your philosophy on that is, but also the freedom that you allow guys to play with, whether that's, like, yeah, I want you to try, like, go deep in your bag, play one-on-one sometimes, stuff like that. If you could talk about that.
Yeah, I think for us, having multiple ball handlers, it's an important thing in terms of just how we play stylistically. And when we're recruiting guys, you know, we tell anybody and everybody, like, hey, if you're a perimeter guy here at Kent, you know, you pretty much have to be able to handle, pass, and shoot. Shoot. Like, one-dimensional guys are not as good for us. Some people have awesome, awesome shooters that they can run off screens and do different things. You know, we don't utilize those guys quite as well as we utilize two guards or three guards or three different guys who can break guys down off the bounce and get in the paint or play off ball screens. And, you know, sometimes when you do that, you know, a natural size for a wing or a natural size for a two guard, like Jalen, for example, would be small for a two guard, if that's what you call them. And he probably doesn't have quite the instincts I don't want to say instincts, but his makeup is to try to score. So, you know, if he's your point guard and your only point guard, on the college level, at the professional level, might be different where he's going to play. They may want a scoring point guard. You know, at the college level, it might be tough for his teammates to get involved with him because he can really, really score, and that's where his head was at as a collegiate player. As a professional, it's going to have to adjust a little bit. But, you know, we're going to play with multiple guards. So, yeah, they do have freedom. Sometimes that freedom doesn't always look great on offense because, you know, there may be some times where people, you know, question our shot selection. I have to do a better job as a coach with that. That's something I'm working on in the off season. I ask our players to work on things. I also have to work on things each year in terms of trying to get better. But there are non-negotiables on the other side of the court. To see the floor, you have to defend and you have to compete defensively. So, you know, what people see is, hey, you give your guards a lot of freedom on offense. And I'd like to think I do. And conversely, you have to play really, really competitively defensively to earn that freedom offensively. And using Jalen as an example, because as an incoming freshman, you know, Jalen didn't, you know, he thought he played defense, but Jalen didn't play defense as a freshman. Me and him can laugh about it now. We didn't laugh about it as a freshman. But, you know, as he grew in the program and understood what I considered competing, you know, he became a really, really good defensive player. And where he had some deficiencies, he made up for it in other areas by his effort level. And those are the things, you know, that we're looking for. And you know, when we played St. Bonaventure, we played really well that night, obviously, to beat them the way we did. And those two guys had really good games, for sure.
I want to talk more about this defense aspect of your program, because it's, you know, I listen to the Basketball Immersion podcast, and this, you know, how we do research and stuff like that. It seems like it's a really big part of your program, right? Defense and toughness. Like, and KJ mentioned in off air talking about how you did a clinic at Norfolk State, and you mentioned to the guard, you're like, hey, like, we could blitz this ball screen, but me personally, I want all my guards to blow this up. And I heard you talking about how, like, you aim to have an 80% contest rate. So when you're watching the film, even if your guys aren't even that close to the shooter, you still see your guys closing out all the way, and they're going to be there on every contest and making sure, you know, the shooter feels them. So just for me, and it's interesting to hear this stuff, and I want to just talk about how your defensive philosophies, you know, just developed over time, and how you and what the implementation process looks like for young players in your program.
Yeah. Well, I worked for, I only spent 2 years, but I worked for probably the best, and I would take the word probably out, but, you know, to me, the best defensive coach in the country, which is Coach Sampson, right? And I don't know who, I guess people can argue, okay, if he's not the best, he's tied for the best. Like, you're not getting better is what I would say. And I only worked for him for 2 years, but, you know, I worked for a number of really good coaches, but for whatever reason, like, it might have been my age or my development as a coach, those 2 years watching how he played stylistically, Coach Sampson, I felt like that aggression defensively, that fit the way I wanted to coach as a coach if I ever had the opportunity to be a head coach. So when I was here for Coach Ford, he was a really hard-nosed defensive coach too. And we were great defensive teams when he was here. So, you know, we haven't always been great defensively, but we always put an emphasis on that end of the floor. And the way our teams have evolved is like creating turnovers, rebounding, and competitive toughness are really the staples of our program. If we're playing well, people are going to say, boy, they're really, really competitive. They go to the offensive glass like wildfire. Like, they're going hard. And their ball screen coverage in particular, because everybody ball screens, they're making it really, really difficult for offensive players. Now, you know, we get attacked, and there's games that we're not as good as we need to be. And there's times that I'm disappointed in what we've done. But, you know, those are staples of, like, this is who we are as a program. I'm really comfortable coaching it this way. And our players, you know, they are confident. I think that has as much to do with it too. Like, they understand, like, hey, this is how we win. We win because of this. We don't win because of, you know, we try to execute. We do. Everybody tries to execute, but we don't win because of offensive execution, pretty boy stuff. We win because of competitive spirit. That's how we win. That's what we have to do. So that's sort of the trademark, and it's evolved. And there's each year, like, people are making adjustments on how they play offensively nationally, and we're trying to make adjustments to keep up or to stay ahead with how we're guarding things defensively.
Yeah, Coach, that's big time. One defensive point that I heard you talk about on the same podcast we were to mention, you were saying, and this is gold. You like to hedge the ball screen because you can teach the back line kind of how to guard that, right? You know what I'm saying? How you can teach what you've seen enough guards how they react to like a hard hedge, so you can teach the back line on what to do on the back end. So as a point guard, I'm kind of, you might be giving some sauce away, but like, how do you, I guess this is a bad question, but how would you dissect like how to beat a blitz or a hedge ball screen?
Yeah, that's a good one, because, you know, again, I think a lot of that has to do with your personnel outside of you, right? Like, so, you know, if you're constantly giving the ball up quickly, like, okay, and the guy you're giving it up to isn't great at making decisions, well, then that's playing into the defense's hands, right? But if the guy you're giving it up to is a good decision maker, well, then you're going to be able to pick apart the defense. So, again, I think a lot of that is your personnel driven and who's setting those screens. And that's where we have to start making adjustments on things. Like, maybe if a great decision maker is getting all these short rolls, we gotta mix some things up and do some different things. But, you know, the way we teach it is very consistent. The rules of what we do are very consistent. And then, you know, the execution becomes the most important part. And ultimately, you know, when it's all said and done, you know, you the players make plays or they don't make plays on both ends of the floor. You know, that's the bottom line. Either they do or they don't. So you try to bet your best to put guys in the best position to have success and try to stay consistent to me with what you're teaching, whatever that might be. That would be my biggest advice to coaches first starting, is like, it's not what system is the best system. In college, that's the beauty of college, is like, you got 15, 20 different ways to play, and all of them have proven they can be really, really successful. You know, you can play slow. Coach Bennett, you know, from Virginia, you know, was somewhat methodical. You know, you can play fast. You can play zone. Coach Boeheim won national championships. You can force baseline. You can force middle. You can trap. You can do whatever it is you want to do, you know, but you got to believe in what you're doing and be able to teach it. You can be, you cannot worry, you know, I don't want to say not worry, but you can be offensive minded and have awesome offensive execution and out execute people. That can be how you win games. Like, there's so many different ways you can win in college that I think it's different than the NBA, because the NBA shot clock, the NBA's defensive rules, I think create, not that there's one style, because that's unfair to say, but there's less styles that you can win with in the NBA. Whereas in college, I think there's so many different ways you can do it, but it's like, it's got to fit you, whoever you are as the coach, and then you've got to be able to teach it, and you got to believe in what you're teaching, because if you're constantly, and it's not always going to work, so how do you, if every time it doesn't work, you just change, and okay, we're going to do this, then you're really never getting great at anything, and it's hard to be good if you're not really, really a believer in what you do.
I think you're making great points just about believing, and like you said, like you're talking about, knowing what you're teaching, right? like really being able to teach a freshman that is coming from high school, that has high school principles, right, and teach them like, okay, like when I went to Utica, like teaching us how to play, you know, pack line and being able to understand, you know, that aspect of, you know, college hoops. And I want to talk a little bit about execution, coach. And, you know, you mentioned on the Same Basketball Immersion podcast, it seems like you're very proud of the late game execution aspect of your program, which you should be, right? Because that's, you want to be able to execute late in games. And you talk about how you play mini games at the end of practice. So talk about how you think, you know, the mini games in practice or your late game execution contributes to, you know, postseason wins and the CIT NCAA tournament and now the NIT.
Yeah, it's funny. I probably did that podcast prior to us losing. We lost the last 4 seconds. We were 4 seconds away from going to the NCAA tournament, and we fouled up one in the backcourt. That same year, we were up 5 with 4 seconds to go against James Madison. I think we had like a 25-game home winning streak that we were up 5 with 4 seconds to go and lost that game. So I should stop talking about late game execution because we have found ways to lose more late games than anybody that I can imagine over the last couple of years. But, you know, we do look, and again, that goes back to my point of like, you know, this is not about the coach. This is, at the end of the day, your players execute or they don't execute. And you try to put them in the best positions. And we do practice. We practice a ton. You know, sometimes when you don't make free throws, the fan, you know, fans will say, well, do you practice free throws? No, we don't practice free throws. No, we don't. We just stand there and tell these guys to miss free throws. I mean, it's, you know, what a ridiculous comment, you know. So what we do is we spend a lot of time with these 60-60 games or 4-minute games at the end of practice, trying to get ourselves in the right frame of mind of what it takes to win close games, you know. And this year, you know, we had not done a ton of that. And then about halfway through the year, we were struggling late in games. Not that we hadn't done a ton of that. We had, but we had done it differently. We changed how we were doing it. About halfway through the year, you know, we started playing against the scout team with the scout team running the other team's stuff. And we were putting our guys in situations where, like, you were watching. It wasn't blue versus gold. It was everybody who could play in the game was on blue, and we were playing against our white team, which is our scout team. And, like, if you weren't in the game, you had to, like, sort of, like, explain what should we be doing, what should we be thinking, so that we're not just, you know, hooping, so to speak. Like, we're not just down. One of the guys said, well, I was like, well, what are you thinking? He's like, well, I'm out there hooping. Well, that's not helping us win. Like, you got to be thinking while you're hooping, right? So, like, that helped us understand, like, you got to be thinking the game through. You got to be understanding time and score. You got to be understanding what we're trying to get at this time of the game. Like, you know, there's times hooping is great, but there's times where, like, you have to be focused on all of these details that are incredibly important to winning late in games. So, you know, we spend a lot of time on that, and we got better at it last year as the year went on. I think it contributed a great deal to our success as the season went on, is that we really put a point of emphasis on how are we executing, what are we looking for, what do we need to get defensively, offensively out of this possession? And that's also part of defining roles, you know, like that's another thing coaches have to do at some point during the year, is like define roles. And then it's not, you know, your players have to accept those definitions, whether they like it or not, like they have to accept it, but each role is important. Like each role is equally as important. Coach Sampson used to say it takes a special person to be a fifth guard. And it's really true. Not everybody can play that role. You know, some guys, if they're in that role, they're inefficient and they hurt your team. They can only be one of your top two or three guards. But you need a fifth guard. Every team, every good team needs one, because that guy doesn't know. He may not play. He may play. He may need to score. He may not need to score. Those guys are so important to your team's success, but not everyone is built to do that. And obviously not, nobody's saying, hey, I'm dying to be the fifth guard. Like, that's not what everybody aspires to be. But maybe at some point in your career, that's what you have to be. And then eventually you become one of your top two or three. But can you be the fifth one effectively? Not everybody can.
100%. Takes a lot of humility, coach. And also I love, you know, the point just about you're talking about, you know, making sure the scout team can be able to explain what the other team is doing, because this is creating the environment of future coaches in your program. So I definitely love that aspect. But we're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
We're back with Coach Senderoff on the Not Even D2 pod. So, Coach, I know that Brian Windhorst, he graduated from Kent State, and I actually saw a video him talking about your success and how grateful he is that basically you're staying at Kent State. So I'm curious, like, how that relationship started, how often you talk to him, and like his involvement in the program, because you're seeing guys like Adrian Wojnarowski at St. Bonaventure come back to be the GM. You're seeing Steph Curry at Davidson enter the GM. So just talk about your relationship and his importance to the program.
Yeah. Well, I didn't see that video you're talking about, but Brian went to Kent State. He's from Akron, went to St. Vincent St. Mary's High School. And one of his first jobs was as a reporter, and he covered, you know, men's basketball during 2002, 01-02, when Kent State went to the Elite Eight. So he has, you know, a great amount of insight and understanding about, you know, the basketball program here. Brian and I have become good friends over the years. You know, I've known him for, you know, probably over 20 years now. And we've spent a lot of time together. I consider him probably the best. You know, again, to me, he is the best. I always say probably because it's an opinion based. But, you know, as far as a reporter for the NBA, I don't know who's better than him, you know, right now at this stage, in terms of, you know, his reporting and his knowledge of NBA basketball. So he's come back, you know, and spoken to our team. He's done some things with our collective. You know, I gotta broach the topic of him becoming the GM. I like that idea. he may be too busy or not want to give up his main job, but and we may not be able to pay him enough to do it. So, but he's a great ambassador for our program, and obviously, you know, his insight and knowledge to the NBA is really something that, you know, our players enjoy when they get a chance to be around him.
It's definitely awesome to have, like you said, someone like who's accomplished as Brian Windhorst in the, you know, basketball realm, you know, as a supporter for your program and also a supporter for you, coach.
Yeah.
Right. That's, you know, that must be a huge accomplishment. I always say to KJ that, you know, respect amongst your peers is one of like the biggest compliments in my opinion, you know. So the fact that he's, you know, we'll send you that clip of him talking about you. It's actually really cool. It's a cool clip. But, you know, we have a couple more questions before we end this pod, and it's been a great episode. But before we end it, I wanted to know about, just talk about a little bit of the future of Kent State, right? Because you have 288 wins and you're top 10 in MAC history, which is a huge accomplishment. So I'm wondering for you, what's left to accomplish for you personally and for the Kent State program as a whole?
I don't think about the me personally stuff, so it's hard for me to answer that one. For the program, like, we have to get back to the NCAA tournament. Like, that's my goal, you know, and that's my goal for this upcoming season for our team. You know, in our league, the last couple years in particular, Akron, which happens to be our biggest rival, they're 10, 12 miles from us. So if you can imagine, you know, Duke, Carolina at a mid-major level, that's Ken Akron with basketball. And I would love for you guys, if you ever get a chance to come to a game in at the Kent Akron game, I always say, well, I always like to preface, like I say, with Coach Sampson, there's no one better. There may be equal. There's no one better. Brian Windhorst, there's no one better. There may be equal. There may be equal a environment for mid-major basketball, but there's not going to be a better environment than when Kent State plays Akron at either facility, at either arena. And their fans are ruthless. I mean, their fans are mean. Their fans are mean. Our fans, I don't think, are as mean to them as they are to us. But I could be wrong. I may be biased there.
Wait, Coach. But, Coach, yeah. are you hooking us up with some tickets for next year's game?
Yeah, you get tickets. You get tickets to any game you want. Yeah, absolutely.
So, let's do it.
No worry. You'll be behind the bench.
Let's do it.
Yeah, so that's done. But they've run the league the last couple of years, like they have. So you got to give them and their program credit. So like we got to catch them again and pass them. And it's not just them, because Miami of Ohio's on the come up. Their Travis Steele's done a great job there, and Jeff Bowles is a really good coach and a good program at Ohio. And Toledo has done awesome for a number of years, and there's a relatively new coach at Bowling Green who's done a nice job, and Ball State. And you can go on and on in our league. And then our league's adding UMass from the East Coast, who, has tremendous basketball tradition. And Frank Martin's coached in a Final Four. So I think that brings great prestige to our conference, having him and their program as part of our league. So, like, this league is tough, and we want to get back to the NCAA tournament. So that's really my goal. And it's really my goal for the players too. Like, I want these guys to experience that. There's only like one guy, I think, in my program next year that has experience going to the NCAA tournament. And it's Rico Gillespie. He was a freshman. We have another one, Brendan Moss, who redshirted that year. Like, I want these guys to get that experience, because there's nothing better than when your name gets called on Selection Sunday, when you go practice wherever it is. Last time we're in Albany, and you get a police escort going to the arena. Like, there's nothing better as a player, and then for your school, there's nothing better for your school than to be able to be represented in that. So that's really the only goal I'd say I have, and that's to help our program get back there. This past year playing in the NIT was great. And I hope, if we don't get to the NCAA tournament, I hope we've had a successful enough season to get invited back to the NIT. But the NCAA tournament, certainly the goal. And I'm hoping we can find a way to do that next year.
Coach, I think that you guys are definitely got the pieces, and you're at the helm. So anything is possible getting back to the NCAA tournament with you leading the guys. But real quick, if it's not something big or outside of like competitiveness, does UMass entering the conference change anything like for your program, or it's relatively the same, just another team in the conference?
No, I mean I don't know enough. Like, we'll have to see when we play them. Like, I don't know enough about their program for me to really comment, except that obviously I know, when Coach Calipari was there, they went to the Final Four. Dr. J played there. Like, they have real, real basketball tradition. The coach is Frank Martin, who, was a Final Four coach. So I think it's going to add to our league. Now, the travel makes it tougher, because most of our schools are in the Midwest, right? You've got six schools from Ohio, Indiana, Buffalo, Michigan schools, the Eastern, Western, Central. So three schools in Michigan. So those are all bus trips for us. We'll be charter flying out to UMass and back, which, again, it's not a big deal, but just understand. And for them, it's maybe a bigger deal, because they're going to have to fly six, seven, eight times, to those games, wherever it is outside of maybe Buffalo, where that might make it tougher for them than us. But, I'm not 100% sure how much the dynamic changes, except that I do know they're committed to having a good team and a good program. And all that does is, hey, we're in the same league as them. We've got to up our commitment across the board here to help us compete.
Word. I like that. So, Coach, we usually end the episodes with, you know, something bigger than basketball. And reading through your bio, it's clear that you're big into, like, social initiatives to inspire change. I see that you're on the committee for the Eat Racism movement, which basically is a lot of coaches around the country combining to, you know, educate others or put things in play to inspire change. So I was just wondering if you could talk about, you know, getting involved with different social movements like that, your role in the movement, and maybe if you could tell me some of the other coaches on that committee.
Yeah, I just think in general, like our job as coaches, you know, we have unbelievable jobs, right? Right. Like I get to coach basketball for a living. That's what I get to do. And you know, there's only 350 of these or 60 of these in the country. So I'm really fortunate to have one of them as a head coach and my staff. And part of what we're doing, again, even with the NIL, even with the transfers, even with all of these things that are taking place, that, you know, basketball is a business. It is. It's a business. Even with all that, we still work at universities where part of the mission for universities is to educate young people and help prepare them. Our athletic department's mission statement is, you know, boldly prepared for life after sport. That's part of what our athletic department's mission is. So part of my mission has to be the same, right? So, like, you know, we're involved locally with a lot of different things. We're involved with, you know, we have a soup kitchen in town, you know, that our kids serve at the soup kitchen in town. There's a good friend of the program whose son passed away in one of the wars. He was in the army and he passed away in a war in Afghanistan. And so our guys go and feed, they go to, there's a veterans shelter that they go and, you know, do a cookout one night at a veteran shelter, just because that's meaningful stuff. So, you know, the racism committee is something that I'm part of. There's just a lot of different things. Our guys do a lot of different things to try to give back. We play Cleveland State every year and it's our coaches versus cancer game. And up in Cleveland, which is 45 minutes from Kent, there's a place called Hope Lodge, which allows people to stay free of charge, families of people that are getting cancer treatment, that allows them to stay with their families right next to the Cleveland Clinic, which is one of the best cancer facilities in the world. So people from all over the world go to Hope Lodge to stay as their loved ones are getting cancer treatments. And we went up there one night and you know, spent the night, had dinner and played games with folks that are there. I think it helps your players with perspective on some things. And it also is giving back to the community. And, you know, whatever those committees are that I'm involved with, or whatever initiatives that I try to stay involved with, are things that, generally speaking, you know, we're giving back, but being involved gives more back to us or to me, and I hope to my players, than it does what our involvement in the organization has to do with. So, you know, that's really the short of it.
Nah, I definitely. I love that you're using just your platform to, you know, enact change, and also like bring your players to the, you know, the soup kitchens, the veteran, you know, veteran, like, you know, talking about the veterans, right? You know, going to the hospital, like all that stuff is really cool. And especially as a player too, like you said, you're giving them a different perspective and, you know, humility, you know, to know that, you know, we're playing Division I college basketball. You know, you said you're coaching Division I college basketball. Like, you know, we got it good in some aspects. So being able to have the humility to like be around, you know, those people and spend time with them is awesome. And I love that, Coach. And, you know, usually at the end of these episodes, we do rapid fire and starting five, and rapid fire is my segment. So I got three questions for you.
Yep.
So first rapid fire question, what is your favorite non-basketball sport to watch?
I like football. I like to watch football. Yeah.
Football. What's your favorite team?
Well, my favorite team's the Jets. So that's not a great team to love, but that's my team, Jets.
Okay. Okay. I'm a Giants fan myself. Yeah. Next rapid fire question. What is the most underrated Mac arena to play in besides your own?
Well, underrated. Well, for us, it's Akron, the Jar, because of how it is for the game. Now, I hate giving them play. So outside of our game, I can't give them that play. Outside of our game, I would say back in the day, Buffalo was so tough to play in, man. That place used to give me nightmares. We used to play Buffalo. It was like almost every time the game would get moved to Friday, and it would get moved to Friday night at 9 p.m. I remember there was one time Coach Hurley was there before Nate Oates, and it was like that place was rocking. So, like, Buffalo is an underrated arena, and, you know, they're struggling now, but I think their coach is changing things around back to make that a really tough environment again. But I'll go with Buffalo.
That's a good choice. And I know that game was moved definitely because of the snow. The snow is unforgiving in West
Virginia. Sure is. Yep.
And then last rapid fire question I got for you. What what is the Mac road trip that you enjoy the most?
That I enjoy the most Mac road trip.
I know that may be a tough, kind of a weird question.
Yeah. I'll give for that one, I say Bowling Green or Toledo because it's the closest, right? Akron, we don't even travel the night before. We just go the day of the game because it's 10 miles away. So we're back home. But, you know, the Ball State one is long. I don't like that one. Miami of Ohio, long. I don't like that one. Same with Central. Bowling Green, Toledo. Either of those I'll go with because that's an easy one. We're in, we're out, 2 hours, we're back home.
All right, so we're going to end this episode with a starting five edition. So if you're a coach assembling a lineup, point guard through center, who's your lineup going to be? And this edition is going to be the best defenders that you've coached, you know, defensive mind. So I want to hear the best defensive guys. And tell me what position they'll play in your lineup.
At Kent?
Yeah, or throughout your whole career, throughout your whole career.
I'll just go at Kent because that'll make it easier. All right. Kalik Spicer is going to be the center because he was a defensive player of the year. Malik Jacobs is going to be one of the guards. He was defensive player of the year. So that's two of them for sure. Sincere Carey, he was on the all-defensive team multiple years. That's three of them. Booman Williams, that's four of them. Although Booman, every once in a while, I know he'll hear this, and every once in a while, he didn't guard the way he needed to guard, but he was on there. And then the fifth one, see, I've had a couple that I don't want to leave people off because guys will get upset. Claron's going to get upset that I didn't pick him, Claron Hornby, because he just graduated. But Kalik was the defensive player of the year, Claron, so he gets that over you. Jimmy Hall didn't guard. Like that. I've had a lot of good players. Jalen Walker was awesome, but I can't put him. He wasn't defense only. The other guy I'm going to put, and he never got on an all-defensive team, but he deserved to be because we won a championship, and I thought he was our best defender. And I don't – at that time, I think they just had defensive player of the year. They didn't have all-defensive team. And I think he should have been that, but he didn't get it as a kid. He's not a kid. He's a young man named Derek Jackson. He's still playing overseas right now. But he had unbelievable defensive instincts. So I'm really putting D-Jack, Booman, Antonio Williams, Sincere Carey, Malik Jacobs, and Kalik Spicer. And I know I'm leaving guys off that are going to be upset with me, but I'm putting those five are going to be the five I'm going to say today. That's who I'm putting today.
That's a really good lineup, Coach. Definitely got some defensive guys you've coached, and we're excited for the future of Coach Senderoff's career. Appreciate you getting on the pod. It's been a really good conversation and episode, and good luck next year.
All right. Thanks, fellas.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Not Even D2.
Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you follow us on Instagram, Twitter. That's the best way to support the channel.
And all episodes released on iHeartRadio, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts. That's going to do it. And we'll see you next week on Thursday.
Yo, bro, that was a fire episode.
OD.